Then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." Then I saw a lamb, looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. The lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the lamb. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of God's people. And they sang a new song, saying, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." Then I looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. In a loud voice they were saying, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them saying, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever." The four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshipped.
When things become part of your everyday life, it's easy for them to be taken for granted. You know, so the drive to work and that amazing view that people travel for miles to come and see. And for you, it's just the journey to work. You see it every day. It's nothing to behold. Or we take our families for granted, you know, our wives and husbands and all they do. And it's only when they go away, maybe for a day or for a couple of days, and you suddenly realize all they do and how they help. And for the Christian, the cross can sadly become like that. That we begin to take it for granted. That we become complacent. We would never say it's not important. You know, we would never say our wives or husbands are not important. But we end up just taking them for granted. You know, we'll sing on the cross. We might mumble, you know, a thank you to Jesus as we pass the bread and the cup around. But it just becomes so familiar, so part of our language, so part of our understanding that we kind of lose its awe, like the journey to work. We fail to see its significance. We just take it for granted. And Revelation 5 is a very helpful passage at reorientating our view of the cross. So have a look with me. The first thing we see in Revelation 5 is that God has a plan for his creation. God has a plan for his creation, verses 1 to 4. See, verse 1, "Then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals." So here is God, God himself, sitting on his throne, and in his hand is a scroll that is sealed. Now, the background to understanding this scroll and the seals is found in the Old Testament, particularly in Daniel chapter 12. Daniel chapter 7, Isaiah 29 verse 11, and Ezekiel 2. But it's only in Daniel 12 and Daniel 7 where the sealing and latter-day unsealing of the books of the scrolls is mentioned. So we read in Daniel 12, verse 4. You might want to flip back to it. Daniel 12, verse 4. Where we read. Daniel's one of those cheeky books to find, isn't it? It's just tucked away. Daniel 12, verse 4. We read, "But you, Daniel, roll up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge." Or right down to verse 9. "Go your way, Daniel, because the words are rolled up and sealed until the time of the end." And it seems, therefore, that what John is about to witness here in Revelation 5, and in effect the rest of Revelation, is the fulfillment of Daniel's 500-year prophetic vision. The scroll that Daniel saw sealed is now about to be opened. Now, what's on these scrolls? Well, it seems for the context of Daniel 12 and the book of Daniel and Ezekiel 2 and Isaiah 29 and then from what is described in the rest of the book of Revelation as the seals are opened in the very next chapter, it seems that the scroll contains God's sovereign plan for his creation. It's going to contain judgment and redemption. It's going to encompass the development of all history from the cross to the coming of Jesus again to the new creation and beyond. So what, in effect, what Revelation 6 and onwards describes, it describes the last days, the days from Christ's death through to his coming again and beyond. So what, in Daniel's words, were called the end times. So all that has been promised and foreseen in the Old Testament, which is likely what is the writing on the outside of the scroll is referring to. And all of this has been set in motion by Christ's death and resurrection, but has yet to be completed. It's very striking that the description of the scroll and the seals mirrors that of a Roman will, which was witnessed by seven witnesses, all of whom placed their seal on the will. On the outside of the will was a brief summary of what was inside. But the will could only be open upon the death of the person whose will it was. It took a death to open it. And the scroll here with its seven seals could only be opened upon a death. Like the scroll that Daniel saw, it could only be opened upon the death of the King, the Messiah. And so here's this scroll containing God's great plan for his creation. Note the link back to chapter 4 last week, that the God who is the creator, who sits on his throne, is now the God who will judge and redeem and renew his creation. But only once it is open can we read and know the plan. And so verse 2, we see a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll? Who is equal to opening such a scroll and revealing God's plan?" And verse 3, we discover there's no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. In other words, there's no human who could do this. There's no sinful being who was worthy. There was no sinful being who was equal to the task, because whoever would open it would also be the one to put it into effect, to bring God's plan into force. It's a bit like only Theresa May can write the letter that begins to put into force the plan the country had voted for, Brexit. Only the one who opens the seals, who reads the scroll, can put God's plan into effect. And as John sees, there's no one who is worthy. Verse 4, he weeps. No one was found worthy to open the scroll, to look inside, to put the plan into effect. And his weeping is like the laments of the prophets, such as Jeremiah, as they see God's people facing judgment, apparently without hope in their unworthiness and in their sin. And as John beholds creation, no one worthy, and he weeps. He weeps at its sin, and he weeps that there's seemingly no hope. Will God's people ever be finally saved? It's the weeping of one who feels his sin and the unworthiness of all humanity before a holy God. It's the weeping of one who is concerned for the suffering churches, the persecuted churches of chapters 2 and 3, and wondering, is there hope for them? Will there ever be any protection for God's people? If the seals are not opened, if God's plan is not brought into force, how will it be? And aren't there days when we feel just like him? When we see our sinfulness, when we see the sinfulness of the world we live in, our fallen nature, when we're crushed by disappointment, when we're faced with loss, when we're faced with sickness, when we're faced with brokenness, the brokenness of our bodies, the brokenness of the systems that are around us, be it the NHS, be it schools, and we wonder, is there any hope? And we see the suffering of millions. We hear of the horrific persecution of the saints, and we're grieved by the effects of the sin and the judgment on this world, and we weep. And at that point, what do we do? Well, the answer is the same that John received. The plan will be fulfilled. Lift up your eyes. See Jesus. See, God has a plan for his creation, and verses 5 to 8, at the center of God's plan is the cross. At the center of God's plan is the cross. Now, it's worth remembering that as we see this vision, we don't precisely know when it happened. It's post-cross, and it has happened. But what the vision is revealing more significantly is the answer to the question, who is worthy? Who can open the scroll? Who is equal to putting into effect God's plan? Who is this one who will be able to bring in God's judgment and redemption and renewal for his creation? Who is this one who's going to be able to bring about the new creation? And verse 5, we're told, then one of the elders said to me, do not weep. See, look, behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals. And it's striking that the elder does not just say, hey, it's Jesus, that he uses two titles of Jesus that come from the Old Testament that emphasize who Jesus is and his authority and his conquering rule. So the Lion of the tribe of Judah is a reference back to Genesis 49 and verses 9 to 10. It's the promise, isn't it, of a lion-like king coming from Judah's line. And Jesus is that one. He's God's anointed king from the Lion of Judah. He's the one with God's authority. This is the promised king. And then coupled with that, we read that this one is also the Root of David. And it's picking up the language of Isaiah 11, verse 1 and 11, verse 10. It's messianic language. It's the hope of Israel. This one who will be the Root of David, we learn in Isaiah, is the one who will restore things. He'll be the one who will conquer and defeat Israel's enemies. He'll be the one who brings judgment and salvation. And it's spelled out very clearly in Jeremiah 23, verses 5 to 6, where we read, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land. And in his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will live in safety. Do you see what's being promised? This root will come. And he'll conquer, and he'll defeat enemies, and he'll bring safety and rest for God's people. But do you notice well in that, Jeremiah, that this branch will be raised up to David. In other words, he's also before David. This one who was promised in Isaiah as a branch will come after David, we're told, was also before David in Jeremiah. In other words, he's the pre-existent, eternal Son of God. And these two titles begin to tell us that this one who is the promised king is also the one who will come in conquering rule. And he is not only the one who will come in conquering rule, he will bring safety and rest and judgment and salvation. And he is the Son of God, the pre-existent, eternal one. But his titles alone don't make him worthy. No, the elder tells us that as God's anointed chosen king, as the root, the branch that conquers, as the Son of God, he has triumphed. That which was foretold in both Isaiah and Jeremiah has come true. He's victorious. He's overcome. He's come in conquering rule, and as such, he's able to open that scroll because of the triumph. And how is that triumph and victory won? Verse 6, have a look. This lion, this king, this conquering one, the Lord of Lords, is now seen as a lamb. As we read verse 6, and I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne. It's a picture of the cross. This triumph, this victory, doesn't come through military prowess and power as one might expect, but through weakness, through the laying down of one's life, through the very death and the slaying of God's anointed, his perfect, sinless Son, on a cross, just as Isaiah had spoken of and foretold that this root who would be this servant would, as we read this morning, Isaiah 53 verse 7, be oppressed and afflicted. Yet he didn't open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Where was the triumph seen? At the cross. As Jesus triumphs over sin, as he triumphs over the judgment of sin, death, as he triumphs over Satan, and he conquers the great enemies of God's people, and he brings them rest, and he brings them safety, and he brings them hope and assurance and judgment and salvation, which means none can oppose or hinder or stop him. And as such, God's plans for creation are utterly assured. Because Jesus is the conquering king. And he alone, therefore, is worthy. He alone, therefore, is worthy to open the seals and read the scrolls, because he alone can bring about God's purposes and salvation. And he alone can bring about God's justice and judgment. And he alone can redeem God's creation fully, because he alone has triumphed. The cross stands at the very heart of God's plans. Without the cross, there is no plan. Without the cross, God's purposes cannot be fulfilled. There'd be no means of salvation. There'd be no justice that is possible. There would be no redemption. The effects of sin and death and Satan would still rule. But at the cross, these things are broken. So C.S. Lewis pictures it, isn't it, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Remember that great picture as Aslan dies? He breaks the White Witch's spell. Spring is able to come. Yes, there's still battles ahead, but the king's purposes will be fulfilled. The spell's broken. And at the cross, the power of sin and death and Satan's influence has been broken. God's purposes can now be fulfilled. Nothing can oppose them. Nobody can thwart them. The triumphant king will and is bringing them into force. And as it were, to kind of emphasize the centrality of the cross, we read that the Lamb is standing slain, verse 6. In the Greek, it has an ongoing sense that the Lamb continues to exist as slain, to indicate the ongoing victorious effects of his triumphant victory, and how that triumph touches upon and affects all that is to happen. There'll never be a day in eternity when we'll not think upon the cross and its decisive victory that brought about God's perfect plan in both salvation and judgment. And to underline the kind of the sense of the victory and to give us the assurance, we're told, verse 6, that this one has seven horns and seven eyes, and seven, of course, is the number of perfection and completeness. And horns equals power. This one who was slain is all powerful. No one can hinder or oppose. He's all seeing, all knowing. Nothing will go unseen or unpunished. Justice will prevail. His spirit, we're told, is sent out throughout the earth, bringing about his purposes. And then verse 7, we're told the slain lamb takes the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. Similar to the picture in Daniel 7, where, if you know it, the Son of Man being given all authority. And here is now the slain lamb, and he's holding the scroll. He's holding God's purposes in his hand. He's holding, in effect, the whole of history. All authority is given to him. All authority is his because of the cross. And with that, verse 8, the four living creatures and the 24 elders who surround the throne now fall in worship. And each with a harp, pitcher of worship, and they're holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the very prayers of God's people. And Psalm 141, verse 2, helps us to understand this, because we read there, "May my prayers, say David, be set before you like incense." And in that psalm, David's prayers are for God to deal with evildoers, to deal with those who oppose. It's what we see the saints pray in Revelation 6, verse 10. You just flick over and you see them. They're under the altar and they're saying in a loud voice, "How long, sovereign Lord, holy and true, until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood?" And you see a similar prayer again in 8, verses 3 to 5. Put it another way, it's the same prayer that we pray as we say, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." It's the heartfelt prayer for all God's people as we long for God's kingdom and his purposes to be established. And who else to offer them up to than to the one who has ensured victory, who is to bring about God's purposes, who is bringing about God's purposes now, and who has all authority. The cross is at the heart of all history. The cross is what allows us to make sense of history and the future. See, as we look at the world and we see the mess, and as we weep like John because of what sin has caused, when we see injustice, when we see the weak trampled by the strong, when we see the strong succeeding, taking advantage of the weak, as we feel the effects of the fall in our everyday life, from the minor irritations to the major frustrations, without the cross, life's just random. Life is chance, it's a game of luck. And weeping is all we could do. But in light of the cross, not only do we understand the seriousness of sin and we grasp the depravity of humanity, we recognize the world is broken. And we're not surprised, therefore, when life is not as it ought to be. But neither do we despair, because Jesus is triumphant on the cross. And as the triumphant one, he now holds the scroll and God's purposes in our hand, and he has all authority and all power. And he sees all things, and we trust and we rest in the fact that God's purposes are being worked out, that wrongs now will be righted, that suffering now will not last for eternity, that the power of sin and death and Satan is broken. Yes, we feel the presence of those things still, but their power is gone. They no longer determine what will be. We'll be able to rest safely in God's plan. The cross has done that. Jesus has ensured judgment, salvation. He's ensured a new creation. Our weeping now turns to joy and praise. And if the cross is the means by which Jesus overcomes and triumphs over sin and death and Satan, it's where we triumph over these things as well. See, throughout Revelations 2 and 3, each of the letters speaks, doesn't it, of the reward for those who overcome, for those who triumph, for those who are victorious. And here in chapter 5, we're told, in effect, how that is possible. It's the cross. At the cross, we find forgiveness for our sins, for the one who is truly repentant. At the cross, we're remade and renewed. We're brought into God's glorious purposes and plans. And at the cross, we're kept in God's glorious purpose and plans. As I wrestle with my sin, it's to the cross I look, to know that the power of sin is broken, to know that there is another option now open to me, that in Christ I can defeat and put to death my sin. I can put to death my pride and my lust. The cross touches on all of life and into all eternity. When Satan tempts me to despair, upward I look and see him there. I see the slain lamb and know Satan has no hold on me. But I can say no. I can flee. I can rest in God's purposes and plans and in Christ's power. When I fear death, or when I'm confronted by death, it's to the cross I go. I see Jesus' death and know I'm free, I'm safe, I'm with him, and I'm lifted from below. It's the cross that's at the centre of God's plans. And no wonder, therefore, the slain lamb is worshipped. God has a plan for his creation. At the centre of God's plan is the cross. Therefore, Jesus is forever praised, verses 9 to 14. You see the four living creatures and the 24 elders, they now sing a new song. And the song they sing functions as an interpretation of what has been. It spells it out for us. So verse 9, we read, "You're worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals because you were slain. And with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation. You've made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." See, Jesus is indeed worthy to receive our praise for his redeeming work, which will eventually lead to a new creation in chapter 21. He's purchased a people from every tribe and tongue. He's made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve him, to serve the living God in his presence forever, just as Exodus 19 has foretold. And they'll reign, we're told, with him. And there's a sense whereby we reign now with those with him as those in him. But that fulfillment comes on that last day. But it's the cross that's at the heart of it. It's the cross that redeems. It's the cross that's purchased. It's the cross that establishes his kingdom and our reign with him. And thus, at the center of the song is the cross. It's a song that speaks of our salvation. No wonder we're to praise. And then verse 11, the worship expands to include the thousands around the throne. And now they, in a loud voice, say, verse 12, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." And if that is not enough, now we discover verse 13, every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them, saying, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever." It's the kind of Philippians 2:10 language. Every knee will bow. All of creation will worship this one who is slain, this one who is worthy. And you know that word worthy is just repeated all the way through, isn't it, this passage? Verse 2, we see who is worthy. Verse 3, no one's worthy. Verse 4, who was worthy? Verse 9, you are worthy. Verse 12, worthy is the Lamb. And that word worthy has a sense of either who is equal to. That's the implied meaning in verses 2 to 4. Who is equal to, who is worthy to open the scroll. But also worthy can have that sense of who is due. That's the meaning of verses 9 and 12. See, Jesus is worthy of our praise and worship because he's equal to opening the scroll because of the cross. And he's due our praise and worship because of the cross. And so as we read this, it challenges our very sense of worship. It's not just that we sing of the cross or say a few nice words, but that as we sing, we're to give what is due to Jesus because he's equal to it. He rightly deserves our praise, our all, because of the cross. It's why Paul can write, aren't he, in Romans 12, verse 1, therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, the cross, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Worship is giving our all, our due, to him who rightly deserves it, for purchasing us, for making us part of his kingdom, for allowing us to reign with him, for fulfilling God's purposes and plans. And he'll continue to deserve our praise, our all, for all eternity because of the cross. And when you grasp that, you begin to see why idolatry is so wicked. Giving our worship to another, to an idol that is not worthy. Think of those things that you might worship in your life: wealth, power, control, seeking the approval of others. And what have they ever given you? They're not equal to our worship. They're not due our worship. They have never done anything for us, but only enslaved us. And again, you can see why worshipping another at times in the Old Testament is spoken of as adultery. Because you're giving your heart and your affections, that which is rightly due to Jesus and none other, to someone and something else. Jesus alone is worthy of our worship. Because Jesus alone is the triumphant, victorious King who has all authority over all of history, bringing God's purposes and plans into actions, and those plans that include us as those who now reign and rule with Jesus in his new creation, all because of the cross. It's why he is forever praised. It's why we'll never tire of praising him. And it's worth noting as well how the worship here in verse 12, is nearly identical to that of God on the throne in 4 verse 11, underlining the deity of Christ. Another reason why he alone is worthy of our worship. So how will you worship him this week? Who are you giving your affections to that is not him? What are you desiring and seeking more than Jesus? He alone is worthy of your worship. He alone is the one who is due all your worship, to give all your heart and soul and mind to, because of the cross, the glorious cross.